the 21st century, those who change the world are those who change the culture. They get people in sync, lead tribes, create movements, and generate an energy field where ordinary people achieve extraordinary results.
Values and norms and the way people think varies enormously by nation, by occupation, by community, by family, and therefore looking for a good culture or a bad culture is nonsense. Cultures exist in many forms, and the only way I would judge them is adaptiveness. Are the values and the norms by which we live adaptive to the environment in which we're trying to live and succeed? So if an organization says, do I have a good culture or not? I say, that's a stupid question. The question is, how well are you doing as an organization in your environment? And if you're doing well, then you must have an effective culture. If you're doing badly, then there's something wrong with your culture. But you have to judge this on performance, not on some arbitrary external criterion.
I'm Aga Weyer, and this is the Culture Lab podcast, where you will find ideas and inspiration on how to harness the power of team and organizational culture. I talk to leadership thinkers, culture experts, entrepreneurs, and all sorts of movers and shakers, and together we explore the fascinating topic of culture, leadership, and personal growth. If you like what you're hearing, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Better yet, write a review on iTunes and share the podcast with your followers on social media. For more, check out our archive at agabayer.com/podcast. Hello and welcome to episode 14. I have a disclosure to make today. Recently, I was feeling a tiny bit overwhelmed, and a friend of mine asked me why I do this podcast. Because, you know, it takes a lot of time, effort, and money to produce it. And I said, honestly, I just love doing it. And I listed just about a million reasons why. And she said, do you know what? I really think that you have to tell this to your listeners. So here, I'm telling you. Full disclosure, I love doing this podcast for many different reasons, but here are the two main ones. First, I really believe that culture is this incredible force that can make or break a team or an organization. And in spite of the fact that it's pervasive, continuously shifting and evolving, incredibly complex, hard to grasp, hard to see, blah, 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 I know that a single person can have major positive impact on culture. How do I know that? I've seen it happen. In fact, we all have. In its essence, culture change is a movement. And what it takes to create a movement is for someone to show up, step up, and lead it. Someone like you. And the second reason why I love doing this podcast is that I get to speak to really incredible people all the time. Today's episode features someone who doesn't really need an introduction. It's a really special guest. And probably, you know, if I ask someone to name the number one organizational culture expert on this planet, probably 9 out of 10 people would name Ed Schein, Professor Emeritus at the MIT Sloan School of Management. And for a culture geek like me, it was just incredible to have an opportunity to speak to him. And I know that a lot of you have been looking forward to this episode. And thank you for engaging in a conversation on LinkedIn around this. And let me just read some of the comments people left in anticipation of this episode. Steve Benfield said, Ed Schein, what an amazing individual, insightful, practical, and inspiring. Brian Fulham says, Schein is one of my organizational culture heroes. Doug Ramsey, Thanks for reminding me of the work of this great man, a true pioneer and sage, still my go-to guy on all things culture. Blessed to have found his work many years ago. I owe him an enormous gift of gratitude for all I have learned from his work. Lahaja Furaha, I hope that I'm pronouncing your name correctly. She says, thank you at Shine for your many insights and commitment to helping us understand culture's critical impact on the people, structure, systems, and processes within an organization. You are inspiring. Jacqueline Wales, she says, he's an inspiration to all of us to keep thinking forward. And Julie Kaya simply says, love at Shine. So without further ado, let me give you Professor Emeritus of MIT Sloan School of Management, author of many books, Ed Shine. Ed, welcome to Culture Lab.
Thank you. I'm a pleasure to be here and to I always like to talk about culture.
I know you do, and it's a huge honor and tremendous pleasure for me to have you on the podcast. I've personally learned a lot from you about culture, and I know that a lot of our listeners have been waiting for this episode of Culture Lab featuring you as a guest. So thanks again for making the time to be with us here today.
My pleasure.
So, Ed, we usually start these interviews with a very similar question because I try to understand cultural background of our guests. So when you look back at your life, what do you consider the most important cultural influences? What shaped you as a person?
I think what shaped me most as a person is that as my first 6 years in life were in Zurich, Switzerland. My father was Czech and my mother was German, and they were married in Zurich. And then when I was 6 years old, his job as a physics professor ran out because the Swiss and the Czechs had some kind of conflict. So he was a cosmic ray physicist. He moved to the Soviet Union, to Odessa, where he could study cosmic rays in the Caucasus. So then I learned Russian and spent 3 years there. But then Stalin came and we had to leave because the purges were beginning to influence foreigners. In the meantime, he had arranged to go to the University of Chicago. In the interim, I spent a year in Prague, learned Czech, and a little bit of that culture. And then in 1938, came to the Chicago, where I learned basically how to be an American. And so I had already lived through three or four cultures by the time I was an adolescent. So I've always felt I had a broader perspective on things. So when I later, as a consultant, found myself simultaneously working with Digital Equipment Corporation, which was a quintessential American New England culture, and flying quarterly over to Basel, Switzerland to work with Siba Geigy, it was not difficult to see the cultural differences between those two companies and to begin to see the culture at the organizational level was equally obvious. And that extended then to seeing culture in occupations, in communities. It became very easy and natural for me to see culture wherever I looked.
Yes, I can imagine having all these experiences. It's really fascinating. I had no idea that you have been exposed to so many different cultures from such an early age. So when you think about this experience of your early childhood, moving around from one place to another and being exposed to those different cultures, what do you think you have taken away from that?
Well, what I've taken away from that is that values and norms and the way people think varies enormously by nation, by occupation, by community, by family. and therefore looking for a good culture or a bad culture is nonsense. Cultures exist in many forms, and the only way I would judge them is adaptiveness. Are the values and the norms by which we live adaptive to the environment in which we're trying to live and succeed? So if an organization says, do I have a good culture or not? I say, that's a stupid question. The question is, how well are you doing as an organization in your environment? And if you're doing well, then you must have an effective culture. If you're doing badly, then there's something wrong with your culture. But you have to judge this on performance, not on some arbitrary external criterion.
Which I think leads me to the next question, which is, when does culture become extremely important for an organization? Are there any moments in an organization's evolution where culture is particularly important?
Well, I think it's important in different ways at different stages. If you're talking about a startup, then the creation of that startup is also the creation of a culture. The founder, the entrepreneur, has a set of values and norms by which he or she lives. And he or she will hire people who fit his or her own personality and style. And the people they will hire, they will impose those values on the young organization. So culture building and culture creating is the crucial process when a young firm begins. And in my books, I've written a lot about how the executive shapes the culture through not his official pronouncements, but his or her actual behavior. People pay attention to what the founder does and values, and what he doesn't do, and they infer the culture from those behaviors. If they fail, nobody ever hears about it again. But if they succeed, like Digital Equipment succeeded as a young company, then their culture is seen as to be their strength. We succeeded because we did things right. And so the culture is the identity at that stage. In midlife or in older companies, culture becomes important only in relation to problems that the company is trying to solve. If everything is going smoothly, culture is simply there and you accept it and you don't think about it. But if you're losing too many people, or you're doing badly in the marketplace, or you think you're not innovative enough, then the culture question arises. What is it in your culture that may be aiding or hindering the problem that you're trying to solve? But you never go at culture initially without problem solving of some sort. It's simply there for you to analyze if you care to, but there's no point to analyzing your culture unless you're trying to solve some kind of a problem.
What about really mature organizations? Is culture still important? And is it the same situation? It's important when problems arise, or does that change?
Well, you could argue that a mature organization has succeeded because of its culture, by definition. Culture is what determined their values, their approach, their strategy. Culture is much more fundamental than strategy, because culture limits what the mature organization is able to think about. So the problem for the mature organization is that as the environment changes more and more rapidly, the mature organization has to ask itself, is the kind of culture we have adaptive enough to some of the rapid changes that may be going on in their environment. So the adaptiveness of the culture is, I think, an issue in the world today in mature organizations.
And I think it's a really important issue to sort of underline here, because very often we read articles about winning cultures and people will say you have to be this or you have to be that to succeed in the current environment. I just want to stress what you have said now and before, that probably the only element that is really important in all sort of cultures is that they're adaptive enough, because they need to adapt to the changing circumstances.
Exactly. And it's very important then to realize the culture of a mature company has many, many elements, many of which are the strengths of that company. And maybe there are some elements that are weaknesses or that create difficulties in adaptation. So you never talk about the culture. It's silly. It's like saying, what is the culture of Italy? You know, there are many elements to that culture. But if you're saying Italy is having a problem with something or other, then you say, well, what in our Italian culture would help us to solve that problem? And on the other hand, what is it in our Italian culture that hinders our ability to solve the problem? Mm-hmm. So in a mature company, you have to look at the multiple elements of a culture and never think of it as a single thing. It's always a very complex, multifaceted things, just like the human personality is a multifaceted things. So an occupational or an organizational culture has many elements, some of which help and some of which hinder. And you have to be able to decipher that.
So when you have those heritage companies who have been there for a long time, they're quite mature, have been quite successful, and now they experience challenges. However, those aspects of culture that might be hindering the organization in sort of facing the current challenges, they sometimes are also the elements of culture that people are very attached to and very proud about. So what are your thoughts on that? And what can be done if there is a tremendous amount of pride about certain aspects of culture that might not necessarily be very helpful for the organization today and in the future?
Well, I think it's a question of who is made unhappy by a given proposed culture change. And I think the issue there is the responsibility for the welfare of the whole organization clearly is in the governance structure, the board, the CEO, or the internal or external boards, if you have both kinds in some European companies. That group is responsible for maintaining the economic health of the organization. So they would be the group who would be looking at, for example, we are too individualistic, we need to become more team-oriented. The silos, instead of competing with each other, should begin to collaborate with each other. That may be the discovery at the level of the governance of the organization. But that may mean that they start programs of trying to get more teamwork, which may upset the separate barons or managers of the different units, because they're used to their independence. And if now they're supposed to work together, they're going to say, oh, the world is going to hell. We're going to start doing stuff that nobody wants to do. And that's then the problem of culture management and culture change. That would start a program where the board and the CEO would have to begin to ask how do we begin to change the culture, those elements that are too competitive, too individualistic, so that the different units of this organization will become more team players, and that will make us more adaptive. But that may then be a 5-year or 10-year program of maybe changing some of the people and changing some of the structure and certainly changing the reward system. So changing the culture usually means changing the fundamentals of the organization.
And I know that you've been in your work, you've been exploring this possibility of making faster interventions that perhaps are not so wide-ranging to bring about really meaningful change in organizations. Would you say that it's possible to create a culture shift or a culture change with a light touch and in a way that doesn't involve a wide-ranging, huge whole organization intervention, but rather doing things where needed and then iterating and checking basically what works and what doesn't?
Well, I think it depends very much on what kind of change is being proposed. In my recent book called Humble Consulting, I talk about the case of Saab Combitech, where they had 7 research units that competed with each other. And in the history of Saab, they were reporting to different product groups like the aircraft or the car or whatever. And the CEO of the Saab Combitech, which was the technical part of Saab, said, "This is absurd. We've got to create a more collaborative culture." So in a 3-day workshop, he had me on the first day talking about how each organization will develop its own culture around its unique experiences, and taught them each how to analyze a culture by observing a different group in action. So on the second day, each unit elected one of their people to go to some other unit and study them, observe them and see how they did things. And then on the end of that day, they reported to each other all the different things they had found. And on the last day, they realized they had a lot of common interests. And with the CEO now saying, "Look, I'm going to start rewarding you on your joint efforts," they were suddenly very willing to do that because they had observed in each other's units some things that they could use that could be useful across the different units. So from moving from individual competitiveness to a more collaborative activity, if that's your goal, that can be speeded up by a lot of mutual observation, by having people live in each other's units, but it may not work if the problem is something different. So it depends on the problem, how fast you can actually do this.
Which also is what you have just said related to another thing that I was really curious about. I know that you are preparing a new book now, which is Humble Leadership. Correct.
Yes.
It's going to come out in August this year?
In July, yes.
In July. I was wondering, do you think it's possible for leaders within an organization to play this role of a culture consultant, being the person who observes and is very aware and very intentional about evolving the culture?
You see, I think the irony of that question is that the leader is the main and only one who should be doing the culture work. The leader creates the culture through his own behavior. through what he or she rewards, what he or she punishes, what he or she pays attention to. If I'm the CEO of a company and I want more teamwork, if every week I ask each of my subordinates, what are you doing in your organization to build more collaboration with the other units? If I ask them that every week, I guarantee they will all evolve very powerful team building programs. All I have to do is pay attention to it, ask about it, and it becomes a value that people begin to understand. I see this around safety. One of the dumbest things we do is we have specialists on safety, when in fact the CEO should just be asking about safety all the time. You know, are our products safe? What are you doing to make sure they are safe? It's what the board and the CEO values that creates the culture. So they are, whether they like it or not, even if they delegate the culture stuff to HR or to a culture specialist, the employees will pay attention to what the board and the CEO does, not what HR claims to be the culture issue.
So it's not just about those espoused values or the values that companies have on the website or on beautiful posters, but it's actually what values they live every single day, and particularly, as you say, the senior leaders in that organization.
That is so fundamental. I find it hard to believe that people don't realize that, because it's the way they grew up. In their own family, they learned values through what their parents paid attention to. When they went to school, they learned the norms and values of the education that they were getting, whether they were an engineer or a doctor, through what the teachers graded them on and what the teachers talked about. When they entered an organization, they were indoctrinated by what that organization cared about. And that is, of course, the culture of the organization. No matter what they print as "these are our values," those are just maybe some of the desirable things they would like to be. But the actual culture is every day what people pay attention to, value, and punish, and display in their own behavior.
So, two questions that arise from that, and perhaps a hypothetical scenario. So let's imagine that you work with a leader who wants to strengthen and cultivate a coaching culture within his organization. What would you tell him or her in terms of advice of what he or she should be doing to reinforce that coaching philosophy and coaching approach in his or her team?
Well, the first point, and this is very, very important, I wouldn't tell him anything. I would ask him, why do you want to create a coaching culture? And I would work with what his reasons are, what problems does he see, what does he mean by coaching, and I would invite him to examine his own behavior. I might ask him, for example, well, do you coach your immediate direct reports? How do you coach them? Do you ask them to coach their immediate support reports? How do they do that? I would force him to figure out what the present state is in terms of what they're doing, why he thinks it needs to change, and then invite him to ask himself how he would change his own behavior in order to make his direct reports do what he wants them to do, and for them to pass that on to their. It cascades down level by level. It's not something he announces and has a program or trains people, it starts with what he does with his direct reports. Now, it may be that that CEO says, well, I don't know how to coach my direct reports. Then maybe the next step is you, the CEO, should take a coaching training program so that you can do it with your direct reports. And if that training program was useful to you, then you send your direct subordinates to that same program. So I'm not saying training wouldn't be involved, but the training would start with the CEO who wants to make the change. It's not something he or she could delegate to somebody and say, okay, HR, you develop a program to have everybody coach, while the CEO continues to behave in ways that may undermine the very things that he or she wants to do. It's got to start with their own behavior. There is no other way to do it.
Yes, and as you said, even before that, it starts with why. And how is that going to serve our business? And why do we feel that we need to change that? Which is also something that you've mentioned earlier, that every culture change has to be linked to a certain problem or a certain business need. Because all the initiatives that want to change or shape culture just for the sake of culture usually fail.
I mean, a good example right now is lots of companies are worried about employee engagement, right? There are all kinds of organizations offering employee engagement surveys because somehow they associate the culture of the organization as being what either will engage or not engage the employee. So if someone comes to me with a question of how can I improve employee engagement, I would ask the same question. What's the problem? Give me an example of why employee engagement is either hindering you or hurting you in some way. And they might say, well, for example, we are very rude to our customers because the employees don't really care about our products and our company. So now we have the beginnings of a diagnosis of, say, well, why do you think they behave that way? And we then probe, and I might have some hypotheses that because it's very common that it's middle management and supervision that is violating some of the senior management values, and in that process, making life unlivable for the new people coming into the organization. I have several grandchildren who went to organizations that claimed to have a very good culture, but their first boss was so rude and so autocratic and so uncaring and unempathic that within 6 months to a year, they quit. Even in an organization that had trained them through a one-year management program. So in that organization, I would say, well, obviously, the problem is not with the employee engagement, but it's that your supervisors and their bosses are not living by the values you claim in your training program. So it again starts with, what is it that you're doing, you the CEO are doing, that would allow supervisors to be so rude to these new employees whom you've trained for a whole year that they get turned off right away and leave. So we would then say the problem isn't an engagement survey. The problem is you're not able to get your own values down through the system well enough, probably because you're not enforcing those values with your own direct reports.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk a lot about the fact that there is no one culture, obviously, and there are a lot of subcultures in organizations. And I think what a problem that a lot of organizations face is that there are departments and part of the organization where people at all levels of management live the values, but then there are some other parts of the organization where they don't. So this is an interesting problem then, because you have the same management team, the CEO with his team, and yet somehow that culture and values do not trickle down in the same way to all the parts of the organization. So what's your take on that? How do you explain that? And what can be done about that when there's lack of consistency in how department heads, function heads live those values and cascade them to their teams?
I have to laugh because my answer is always the same. If it's true in an organization that there are units that are not living by the values of the corporate headquarters, the only explanation for that is that somewhere in the corporate headquarters, the CEO or the COO is not enforcing the values. They may be announcing them, but they are not enforcing them, because certainly the department heads report to some interim division head who reports to the CEO. So if the department is not living by those values, it means the CEO is allowing them to develop their own values and is not somehow saying to the COO, why are your departments deviating from our important corporate values? And that COO is not bringing the department heads together and saying, friends, we are violating the corporate values by allowing our subculture to do something different. It always ends up being that managers get what they settle for. If they don't enforce things, they're encouraging subunits to do it their own way. And I don't mean enforcing in the sense of punishing, I mean enforcing in the sense of paying attention. Yeah. If the CEO wants a certain kind of behavior, he or she has to exhibit it and he has to ask about it if he or she sees examples where it's not happening. The CEO can visit that unit and say, why aren't we doing it in the way I would like it to be done? I want to have answers. I want to know why. I want you to justify your different subculture if you have a new way of doing things. We create hierarchies and then we don't use them. The whole point of the hierarchy is to make sure that the values do get enforced by consistent rewards and punishments and questions around those values. Mm-hmm.
So there's no getting away from it. Basically, wherever you see issues like that, probably as a leader, the first question to ask yourself is, how might I be contributing to that?
Exactly. Exactly. And almost 100% of the time, that leader will discover all sorts of things often that they do not do. It's not the leader may say, well, I talk about it all the time. Mm-hmm. But that same leader may go to that department head and notice differences and not ask about them.
Yeah. So it's not just what we talk about. More importantly, of course, is what we do, but also, as you said, what we do not do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Often it's what we do not do, and that's why this principle is what we get is what we settle for. We allow deviations. We don't pay attention to them. We don't ask about them. And then we're surprised when things happen that are different. It happens most in the safety area. Every company announces that safety is number one. But very few companies actually consistently ask supervisors at the production level or at the customer level, what are you doing to maintain the safety and integrity of the relationship? What happens is the middle manager sees that safety is important, but productivity and schedule is equally important.
Almost.
So the middle manager will compromise safety issues in order to maintain productivity standards. And that's what the CEO and the senior manager is blind to. That senior manager says, of course I care about productivity and schedule, and of course I care about safety. But that middle manager realizes that the rewards of getting ahead are going to be linked more to productivity than to safety, unless the CEO keeps asking about safety.
So, dear listeners, ask yourself, what am I doing, but also what am I not doing that might be contributing to the fact that some parts of my organization are not really living the values that I would like them to live. So let's take this from the other side then. Let's imagine that you are a manager at a middle level, and you are experiencing behaviors that and culture that are not entirely aligned with corporate values and not entirely aligned with your personal values. And you want to create a better environment and a better culture for your team. And I know that this intention and that willingness to create a better environment and a better culture for their teams is really something that a lot of people feel. But I think at the same time, they are not sure if they can really be successful in doing that. So I'm really curious to know what your opinion is.
I know that most culture projects do start in the middle because some manager sees a better way of doing something that is better for productivity and better for the employees' feelings about their work. The problem is whether the program that he or she begins is vulnerable to a change above them. So, for example, in a lot of healthcare organizations, they started with improvement programs using the Toyota production system or some other improvement system and changed the whole way in which patients were treated and improved the doctor-patient relationship. And they also had CEOs who wanted to grow the system and got themselves into financial difficulties, left the organization. A new CEO comes in, and the new CEO is told, you know, we have a cost control problem, so, you know, we're going to have to cut back in all the departments. And the first thing that the new CEO does is to cut all the improvement programs. I've seen that over and over and over again. So the improvement programs are valid, but they're very vulnerable. And if I were a middle manager starting an improvement program, I would also work up the chain and say, how stable do you think this will be? Is our whole system pretty stable right now? Or are we going to have a new CEO unexpectedly who will have a different view of how to change the culture or whatever? So influencing upward to stabilize the improvements becomes as important as actually making the improvements.
Yeah. And what advice would you have in terms of being effective in influencing upwards? Because that's definitely another challenge that a lot of our listeners experience when they have a good idea of how to improve things process-wise or environment-wise or whatever it is, whatever they identify, and they approach senior management about that to stabilize, as you said, or to convince them. And very often it's not so effective. What do you think they do wrong?
Well, I think what they probably do wrong is they don't inquire enough why senior management doesn't see the improvement point. They need to identify the nature of the resistance in senior management in order to figure out how to be more persuasive. And if those resistances are that the boss just absolutely will not see the point, I have seen a lot of middle managers who really care about improvement under those circumstances leave the organization. A good example would be, I know of a number of heads of nursing departments where the new CEO comes in and rejects some of the improvements that the chief nurse wants to make. And he or she will at that point say, well, then I'm not going to stay here because I care enough about improving relations with patients and with doctors that I'm committed to that. I'll have to go find another job somewhere. So we have to recognize that none of this is easy if senior management doesn't see the point. But to make the point is not just to make proposals, but to go to the boss and inquire, you know, if we did this, how would you feel about this? How do you think your boss would feel about it? Do a lot of kind of the humble inquiry is an essential part of all this. You don't go charging in with ideas. You go in with questions and say, I wonder if this would work, and if not, can you explain to me why not, and how would you feel about if we tried this? We need to build relationships. The whole point of the new book, The Humble Leadership, is instead of having these very bureaucratic, distant, hierarchic relationships, we have to get better acquainted with each other, what we're calling level two relationships, which I've already identified in the Humble Consulting book. If we get more personal with each other across the hierarchical boundary, then it will be easier to discuss the pros and cons of new ways of doing things. And also it'll be easier for the boss to explain to the subordinate what the new approach might really be and have real understanding, and the subordinate might explain to the boss why something might or might not work. So personalizing, this is a new word, personalizing the relationships is probably the underlying key to all of this. We have to abandon the bureaucratic distance role relationship and substitute more personalized relationships to improve the communication. That may be the ultimately only answer to this, to some of this.
And I think one more thing that probably we will need to abandon is this need to always have a solution and always have an answer and impact and influence rather than, as you say, inquire and understand first. I think the wider management culture up until now has been the culture of having all the answers and solving problems and being the person in the know, whereas what you are suggesting is a shift towards understanding first and listening and then working together to identify the best possible solutions.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And it means the higher person gets the benefit if he or she creates an environment where the report will speak up and say, "Boss, I understand what you want, but you know, I know that something in the system will not work." The boss needs to understand what the subordinate is really saying. And right now, the climate in most organizations is the subordinate has no incentive to really tell the boss the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm mindful of your time, and I think we probably need to move to questions from our listeners.
My name is Morten Abbey from Denmark. I would like to ask about quantitative culture assessment tools from researchers and consulting companies that are increasing in numbers in the market. What is Mr. Shine's opinion on using quantitative methods when it comes to describing culture and identifying cultural gaps?
My son and I have worked closely with Human Synergistics, which is one of these companies that does a very excellent kind of quantitative culture analysis. And there are others like them who do a very thorough analysis, but there are also many, many organizations now that offer a very quick analysis of almost, you know, instant numbers around selected characteristics like employee engagement and so on. And they call those culture analysis instruments. So the first thing is to differentiate those like Human Synergistics, which actually, with a longer questionnaire, produces a picture of many, many cultural elements and gives you a quantitative assessment of what they regard as more constructive parts of culture and less constructive parts of culture. Now, when would you use that is the question. Again, when we've worked with them, I think we're pretty much in agreement that the best way to use the quantitative is when you already have identified a business problem qualitatively, when you've had focus groups or your customers have told you that you've got certain problems, or in the healthcare, the patients are really not very happy with things. When you know you have a real problem and you want to understand how the many elements of the culture might be contributing to it, then I think doing a culture survey, which produces a quantitative picture and allows you also to look then at subcultures within your larger system, because you can then identify by which unit produced which sets of numbers. And if you want to compare across time whether cultural elements are changing, for all those reasons, then a quantitative survey would be the answer. But if an executive comes into a new organization and says, "I wonder what this culture is all about, so let's hire one of these firms and just do a quantitative analysis," the first problem would be, how would that executive know which firm to hire? Because it's the nature of the problem that will tell you whether you should hire a broad assessment like Human Synergistics, or whether you have such a focused issue about employee turnover that you'll settle for one of these quick and dirty employment surveys, things that claim to be culture. So in selecting a quantitative method, you should gear it to what the nature of your problem is. And then once you have the numbers, you do need probably an organization development consultant or someone who may be an internally sophisticated consultant student to help you decipher the numbers, because the numbers by themselves will not tell you what some of the deeper problems are. You may then have to go back into a qualitative process with groups to figure out what to do next, mm-hmm. how to handle the numbers that you've discovered.
Let me add my own question to this question then, because what I've noticed happens in many organizations is that those surveys take place, and sometimes even the group work where organizations try to dig deeper into the meaning of the numbers, and then somehow everything ends up in a drawer and no one has a look at it anymore. Why do you think this happens so often, that nothing basically is being done after that stage?
Well, back to my answer. It means that the CEO did not take the survey seriously and could not figure out anything that he or she or top management should do differently. Probably what I've seen happen in those situations is that the CEO says, fine, we've done the analysis. He says, let's give everybody feedback, give them all the numbers, and let's see if they do anything with it. And abdicates to the departments and says, here are your numbers, see what you can do with it. Instead of saying, I, the CEO, have discovered through the survey what our problem is, and here's what we're going to do, my friends. That message is usually missing, and so nothing happens.
I have a question from Tim Kuppler as well, from Human Synergistics.
Hi, Ed. This is Tim Kuppler. 4 years ago, at the end of my first interview with you, I asked, what one question did I miss, or what should I be asking other culture experts? And you said, I should start with what troubles you. At that time, you said what troubled you was how everything had become culture, how the word had become meaningless. So I'm curious, 4 years later, Ed, what troubles you?
Tim and I and Human Synergistics have partnered now for several years. So we know very well what the trouble is in the culture field, namely that we jump into a oversimplified definition of culture. We run to some quickie culture survey, and then, as you say, very little happens. What troubles me is that we don't take culture seriously and don't ask the question of our clients, what troubles you in your organization, rather than what troubles you in your culture. You know, what's going wrong and what's going right, because culture is pervasive. You're living in a culture all the time, so you can't just pick something like employee engagement and say, well, that's our, we have a culture of bad employee engagement. I would say no. One element of your culture is that your employees aren't engaged. Why is that troubling you? And then if we can answer that question, what's going wrong, then we can begin to work backwards to analyzing all the many elements of the culture that may be involved in either creating good employee engagement or bad employee engagement. But very likely we'll discover other elements. I have a number of very good cases in the Humble Consulting book where the question came to me, let's do a quick culture survey, and my questioning led the client to a completely different answer as to what they needed to do. It had to do, in one case, not with doing the survey, but strengthening the indoctrination program. They liked their culture. They liked everything about it. They didn't need to survey it. They needed to enforce the degree to which they indoctrinated their people. So what troubles me is oversimplification. What troubles me is not understanding that culture is pervasive and deep. We all live in many cultures. We live in a national culture. We live in an organizational culture. We live in an occupational culture. It's inside us all the time. So externalizing it and saying, well, let's go look at culture is a nonsensical approach, and denying how much culture dominates our everyday behavior in the organization and in our daily life.
Hi, this is Dale Hintz. I'm submitting a question to the Culture Lab. And essentially, my question is, why do so many senior business leaders who know culture is very important to achieving strategic plans stay away from pursuing culture initiatives?
Well, the knowledge that culture is important is not the same as knowing that I, the CEO, determines a large segment of how people in my organization will function, that I am the culture manager, whether I like it or not, because that's how hierarchy is built. It's built for people to pay attention to me. So if I delegate it, which is what typically happens, I delegate it to HR, and we have a culture unit, and that unit is supposed to study culture and manage whatever needs to be managed, while I worry about talking to the bankers and keeping my board happy. And I may even tell my COO, you know, I don't have time. I know I'm important, but I don't have time. You manage the culture. I've seen that happen. They're blind to the minute they've done that, they have told everyone that they don't understand culture. If they think they can delegate it, it means they don't understand it. Because what they would have to say is that, or here's how it might play out, which I think happens in some of these scandals, like the Wells Fargo scandal. The CEO was so busy making sure that the stock price of Wells Fargo stayed high, because that's what the quarterly analysts wanted, and that's what the board wants, that productivity, getting more accounts signed up, clearly was what the CEO cared about. So it's then no surprise that throughout the organization, all the junior bankers in the system started building accounts, because clearly that's what the CEO was signaling. The CEO never said, and by the way, these all have to be very good, valid accounts, or I will punish you for writing bad accounts or opening bad accounts. That message never came from the CEO. The only message that came is more and more accounts. It's a clear example. Or in VW, in Volkswagen, the message from the CEO is we must meet these requirements with the present diesel engine. That's what I care about. I don't care about whether we cheat or lie or whatever, but by God, you engineers, you're going to find a way for this diesel engine to meet the California and U.S. requirements. So the engineers delivered. They provided a software program that made it look okay. But it's the CEO who made that happen by saying he cared more about meeting the requirements than whether it was a valid or cheating process. It always ends up being what people look up to the CEO and they say, what does he or she really care about? And they watch the behavior very carefully. And if they think making money is what's really important, rather than being safe or whatever, then they'll do that. Even if there's a culture program simultaneously going on training people to value safety and value honesty and all this other stuff. What matters is what they see the board and the CEO caring about.
Correct. So it's the messages in the goals, in the objectives, in the bonuses, in the various rewards that people get, and also the pressures that they get from the line management every single day. Yeah.
There's no getting away from it. Mm. That's what creates a piece of the culture.
Absolutely.
It's a culture of money. It's a culture of productivity. That's what most business organizations live by. They talk about safety, but what they care about is productivity and good stock prices and good dividends. And so they shouldn't be surprised if that's what middle managers deliver.
Thank you very much, Ed. And we can move on to the rapid fire questions. The first question, we've been talking about culture for so long now, and you are definitely the most frequently quoted person as far as the definition of culture goes. So what is your definition of culture today, and has it changed from what it used to be?
Well, culture is, first of all, a property of a group. So my definition is what a group has learned in its own history, during its existence, that has enabled it to survive and thrive and manage its own internal affairs. Whatever the values and norms are that enable that group to survive and manage its internal affairs is its culture.
What are the signs that a company culture needs some work?
I think the only sign I would pay attention to is if the values and norms inside a given group or organization are in direct conflict with each other, which means that there are subcultures that are fighting with each other. If there are subcultures that do not align with each other, then the company culture has to examine itself and say, why is that happening? Do we care? And what do we do about it? So you never have to worry about a given culture. You always have to look inside and see, are there conflicting subcultures that need attention?
Hmm. Are there any companies that you admire for their culture? And if yes, why?
No, by definition, I think my admiration would vary probably by department, by unit. It's rare that a given company does everything right, and therefore you can say, yes, they have a great culture. I think it's more important to ask which organizations have managed to evolve their cultures to be adaptive. So I would probably admire the same organizations that many of these books do that have survived for over 100 years and have been able to evolve their culture to stay in business. So like Levi Strauss or IBM or Procter & Gamble, These are great companies because they have been able to evolve their culture to remain adaptive.
Mm. Thank you. That's a great answer. I love that. You've contributed a lot to the literature on culture, but apart from your books, is there anything that you would recommend our listeners read on culture, leadership, or growth?
That's a difficult question because the number, for example, of leadership books is in the hundreds and thousands. And I find they differ according to what leadership problem I'm trying to solve. So, for example, in writing our leadership book, we found a book by an ex-Navy captain called Turn the Ship Around, which is a story of how a nuclear submarine was taken over by this captain and how he converted it from being marginally effective and low morale into being a very effective high morale unit. And it happens that this book explains very well how a leader can do that because he wrote in detail about it. So I look for books that are case examples of actual culture change turnarounds rather than general books on culture or leadership. So another book that I think is very, very important today is the book by General McChrystal called Team of Teams, because he's pointing out how traditional hierarchies, especially in the military, are less and less functional for the complex problems that we are trying to work on today. So we relied somewhat on some of his insights into criticizing the traditional culture of management because it emphasizes too much social distance between the leader and the subordinate, when in fact they should be much more open and personal with each other and thereby be more able to work in a teamwork setting. So those are a couple of examples.
Fantastic. So team of teams and Turning the Ship Around, and we'll post the links to these books in the show notes.
Yes, and they should all buy my book in July on humble leadership. Because humble leadership is actually very difficult. There's nothing much about humility that's easy. It's the hardest kind of leadership and yet the most necessary.
Yeah, we're definitely looking forward to the book in July.
I should add, many of the principles are already in the Humble Consulting book. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend that as well.
So readers can read now Humble Consulting, and in July they can get your new book. Right. On leadership. Fantastic. So final question of the rapid fire question series. What is one thing that our listeners can do tomorrow to start cultivating a culture that will help them and their teams to bring their vision to life?
That's a perfect question on which to, in a sense, close, because it goes to this concept of personizing. When we build a friendship or when we try to get acquainted with someone who really interests us, we ask more personal questions, we reveal a little bit more of ourselves. In other words, we personize, we reduce the social distance between us, and we all know how to do that. The big new insight that I'm proposing is we need to do more of that in our place of work. We need to get better acquainted with the people who report to us. And we need to get better acquainted with our bosses and our peers with whom we have to build team relationships. We have to reduce the professional distance between doctors and patients, between nurses and doctors, because those social distances create the bad communication that later then creates the problems that we have to solve. So I'm not saying we have to be friends with our subordinates and bosses, but we have to be more personal and more able to have a personalized relationship in order to feel free to speak up if we don't understand or if we think something is not going right. And if I'm the boss, what I can do tomorrow is to ask myself, is there something I could do to get to know my immediate reports better in order to improve the communication with them?
Yeah, that's just simple things, really, right? Like having lunch together or a coffee together. Asking them about their family, what they did over the weekend. And those are the sort of things that are very easy to do. And yet, very often, managers don't do them because either, as you said, they feel that they need to keep that professional distance or simply they don't prioritize it. And there's never enough time to do that on top of everything else.
And that's the trap of traditional management culture. I think we've been taught that that's how bureaucracies should work. And I think that may have been true until now, when the problems we face require more collaboration, require more teamwork, require more open communication. So we have to change the culture of management toward more personalizing and less professional distance.
Absolutely. So are there any final thoughts that you'd like to share with the listeners before we wrap it up?
I like the final thought that it's all about doing something different yourself tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It's not about reading another book. It's not about finding out what surveys you can use. It's about asking yourself, I live in a culture, I'm in an organization, my organization has its way of doing things. Can I change things around problems that worry me at work? Can I think of a better way of doing something by changing my own behavior?
So one last thing before we end our interview, where can our listeners find you? I feel a little bit, it's almost awkward to ask you because you're so well known in the area of culture, but what would be the best place to go, apart from Amazon, obviously, and getting your books, where listeners could find more about your work and your research?
Well, my son and I formed a little organization called OCLI.org. And if they punch that into their browser, OCLI.org, they will find out a lot about me and my son and what books are available. They can order them all through Amazon. But that's where I would start, with OCLI.org.
Next on Culture Lab, our next guest is Michael Bangi-Stanya. He's the founder of Box of Crayons and the author of many books, including Do More Great Work and The Coaching Habit. In fact, for years now, The Coaching Habit has been the number one book I recommend for managers who want to coach. Here is a sneak preview of our conversation.
I think all managers and leaders could do with being a bit more coach-like. I don't think that means being coaches. I think it means being more coach-like. And for me, more coach-like is a simple but difficult behavior change, and it is this: can you stay curious a little bit longer? Can you rush to action and advice giving just a little bit more slowly? So for me, what I would love is a shift of behavior across organizational life at all levels is just a little bit more curiosity and a little less action and advice giving. Because, you know, most people in most organizations are advice giving maniacs. They love it.
People are talking about building a coaching culture, a program that helps organizations embed coaching in their DNA.
The two-day session for creating and building a coaching culture in the organization, the strategies we have learned is amazing.
An excellent session. It gave us a lot of examples, especially practical examples, and some of them I am definitely going to implement in my company.
It is a good starting point for creating a coaching culture in our organization. And it really had good examples that we can take on into our company.
Aga is very knowledgeable. She has the talent of passing this knowledge over to us. Truly, this is a session I fully recommend.
Very, very good coach. I have, you know, other people to compare, and I think she's a very good, excellent coach.
The seminar was very insightful, empowering, and inspirational. Aga is a great tutor and an amazing coach. So it's the items that I got from this seminar, I can implement them also personally and professionally.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Culture Lab. If you found any moments that were inspiring, fascinating, or maybe even game-changing, don't forget to take a second to share it with someone who'd appreciate it. After all, good ideas are meant to be shared.